You're listening to My Evolved Life, a podcast that simplifies health and fitness and helps you maximize your life. My name is Vuna Nguyen, and I'm the creator of the Evolution Training System. We're so lucky to be living in the information age, meaning it's easier than ever to access information and find answers to any questions you may have. But isn't it confusing when you read information that's conflicting, or worse yet, just sounds wrong? I'll be sitting down with industry professionals to give you clarity and leave you with tangible actions you can take immediately to improve your physical, mental, and psychological health. On today's episode, I had Chelsea Love on the show, a registered dietitian. We had an incredible conversation about nutrition. We covered topics such as intuitive eating, how to read a label, getting screened for celiac disease, amongst many other things. I learned a ton, and I guarantee you will as well. Let's get into the show. Welcome to the show. Today's guest is Chelsea Love. Chelsea has been a registered dietitian since 2010, and her goal is to debunk myths around food and to simplify nutrition to empower others to make tangible, healthy lifestyle changes. Chelsea believes that food is one of life's pleasures to be enjoyed and not feared. And Chelsea's mission is to help her clients find a happy place with their bodies and with food without all of the gimmicks, restrictions, and diets. So with that being said, Chelsea, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. You nailed it.
Oh, thank you very much. You know, you have a great story. We're super excited to have you on the show. I know you're going to be so, so informative for the viewers.
Thank you for having me.
So, nutrition. It is such a massive, massive subject.
Huge.
But today, I really want to get into the topic of dieting. I know it's one of the reasons why so many of us fail in our journeys towards health. So let's start here. From the standpoint of a registered dietitian, what is diet?
That's a great question. So there's a lot to unpack when you ask about a diet, because you could look at a diet as simply what we eat. And you can also look at a diet as something that has a lot of restriction, a lot of rules, a lot of pain and suffering. So if we're talking about a diet in terms of what we eat, it can be extremely healthy. It can be very neutral. If we're talking about the diet in the sense of, you know, dieting, especially to lose weight, especially with a fad diet, then it's not a good thing. It's something that can be very harmful for our health. And my approach is to help people improve their nutrition without dieting. So it's complicated.
It is. So you actually hit a topic right away here. You use the term fad dieting. Mm-hmm. So how would you describe the difference between dieting and fad dieting?
Oh, that's a great question. So when I think of the word fad diet, I think of restriction. I think of hard rules, no flexibility. I think of if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. I think of diets that the company requires you to purchase their products, their shakes, their magic potion. And I worry about that, because although that individual might get results in terms of weight loss, what happens when they stop that said thing?
Right.
95% of the time, it fails.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I know from just reading your bio and what have you, you're not a proponent of dieting per se. Can you get into that a little bit more? Is there a past behind that, or what kind of led you to that stance on dieting?
Well, I think the people I work with often come to me because they've been on the fad diet roller coaster for their whole life. I'm probably going to say women a lot here, because I work with about 80% women. But a lot of women come to me and they've said that they got put on Weight Watchers when they were 12 years old. You know, food for their whole lives was a off the wagon, on the wagon. Am I being good today? Am I being bad today? So I think we need to get back to just eating, just taking the good and bad out of food and working towards those small changes that feel more like little habit nudges, mm-hmm. as opposed to an overhaul.
So what would some of those small changes be?
I think first of all, we need to meet the person where they're at. So there's some individuals who are doing a really good job overall, and they need little tweaks. Like, for instance, hey, I think you might use a little bit more protein at lunch to carry you through a little bit better leading into the afternoon. Little changes like that. And for some people, they're really starting from kind of the ground floor, meaning they need to learn about, you know, what is a balanced meal? What is good sources of protein and fat and carbohydrates, and also not to fear carbohydrates at the same time.
So it's funny that you say that, because, well, you're suggesting that the smallest of changes can have large, large impacts or make large changes. But we as people, we tend to get into this mind space where it's a home run or it's nothing. So either we revamp our whole repertoire, you know, or we just don't do it at all. So how can you, what would you say to a person that says, hey, you know what, changing my lifestyle, it just, it's too much work, so I'm not even going to try. How, what would you say to that individual to urge them along?
Well, we have to get down to the reason why they want to change habits in the first place. Is it because their doctor's making them? Is it because they think they, quote, should? You know, what are the motivators? Do you want to have more energy at 2 o'clock in the afternoon? Is your digestion really bad? Are you dealing with, you know, a ton of bloating, constipation, diarrhea? There's so many reasons to eat healthy. That's not just to lose weight.
So I was just going to ask the question, because I kind of knew the answer already. What is the most common answer or reason that you hear? And it's probably weight loss.
It is. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that inherently. I think, you know, because we grew up in diet culture, right? We just, we have that in our back, in the back of our minds, that we should, you know, be as lean as we can. And I want to challenge that thinking. I think, you know, there is space for the what one of my favorite podcasts, Balance 365, says, in the messy middle, in that you can absolutely try to lose weight as long as it's done in a healthy way that feels sustainable in the long term, but you don't have to lose weight. There's also this, you know, body positivity and health at every size movement, which is incredible, and I think it's so important. Those approaches really want to move away from weight loss altogether. And I'm sitting here kind of in the middle, in that, you know, I definitely work with people with goals to lose weight, but we absolutely make sure that it's health first, weight loss second.
Absolutely. That sounds like a great reason. Now, we just had to have you on the show for the primary reason that the whole reason this show exists is to clarify all of the misinformation, because there is so much, there is an abundance of information out there. And one of your philosophies is to debunk myths.
Yeah.
So if you were to pick a top one or top three, whatever you choose, what would those be?
Oh, gosh, there's so many.
There are so many.
So many. I guess if I had to pick kind of the top ones, I really want to debunk the myth that we must detox our body. That, you know, come January or September, I mean, pick a month, people want to do a, you know, a 30-day cleanse and clear out all the, quote, gunk in your system. And that's simply not based in science. We know that our livers and our colon and our kidneys are really good at detoxifying us. And unless it's a, you know, drug addiction scenario, or it's bad enough that you need to be hospitalized, you do not need a detox.
Right.
That for sure. The other one that I love to myth bust is all the confusion around carbs. Okay. When people say, oh, well, I can't eat bread. Bread is fattening. And my eye twitches a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, carbs are not inherently bad. In fact, no food is inherently bad. But I think carbs, especially in the last 5 or 10 years, with the, you know, very low carb diets, the keto diet, etc., people are really having quite a worry about carbohydrates. Like, are bananas bad? Are carrots bad? Firstly, let's take good and bad out of the equation altogether. Secondly, carbohydrates are what our body lives on. It's the gasoline in the tank. And there's not a single case in my 10 years experience that someone's health issues or their weight gain was because of fruits and vegetables.
Right.
It's just not the issue, right?
Right.
People forget that carbohydrates do include fruits and vegetables and dairy products and beans and lentils and all sorts of health-promoting foods. Often when they say, you know, I've cut out carbs, they mean they're not eating bread and cereals and pasta and that sort of thing. And there are reasons why people need to be careful of gluten, of course, with celiac disease, etc. But for the average healthy person, there's no reason to cut those things out, even when you're trying to be healthy and lose weight as well.
So it is very interesting because these myths, they exist for a reason.
Yeah.
Right. Now, we are kind of a followership type species where if we see Jane losing weight because she's on keto, or we hear Steve speaking about intermittent fasting at the kitchen, we're going to try to follow suit because somebody else experienced success.
Right.
We are going to try it and try to experience the same success. So with that being said, do you see social media playing a role on contributing to these myths?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think social media can be a good thing and a bad thing. I mean, it gives a platform to a lot of professionals to get our messages out there, for sure. It's a free platform, so it's accessible. But as you know, there's a lot of noise out there. And, you know, looking at the actual credentials of an individual, not just if they have visible abs or thousands of followers.
Right, right. So I was just going to ask, how does one who is, I don't like to use the word layman, but, you know, just the average person, how is he or she, without knowledge, supposed to differentiate from somebody who has knowledge or somebody who doesn't, without just making a snap judgment, oh, he or she has a six-pack, so they know what they're doing?
That's right, yes. In nutrition land, you can look for the initials RD, or registered dietitian. Here in Alberta, the College of Dietitians also protected registered nutritionist and the title nutritionist as well, but that's not true across the country. So that is a pretty good start, for sure. That's not to say that there aren't amazing professionals on nutrition that are not dietitians. There's a ton of them. But you want to look at, you know, do they have any credentials at all? Are they selling something? Are they pushing a product? Are they trying to recruit you to their team?
Right.
A few red flags for sure. But I think starting with looking at their credentials, looking them up, are they registered under a college, you know, of nursing, a master's of public health, of dietitian? That's a good place to start for sure. Now, nutritionist outside of Alberta, it does not have regulation. So you can have anyone calling themselves a nutritionist. And I know of a lot of nutritionists that are amazing, incredible, and full of good information. And I also know of some nutritionists that give questionable advice, too. So you have to look at what kind of advice are they giving out? Are they, you know, pushing the no pain, no gain, weight loss over everything, look at my abs, you can do it too? Or are they more of a moderation-based approach? That's a pretty good sign.
So I want to give the viewers some tangible examples.
Okay.
Do you have clients come in with a preconceived notion of what they should be doing, and you just had a difficult time convincing them that, hey, look, what you're doing may not be working for you?
Yes, definitely. Clients come with a lot of food rules, especially if they have a long history of dieting. For example, well, I can't eat after 7 p.m. That will turn to fat. They've got food rules like, I'm not allowed to have carbohydrates after a certain time, or you can see there's a lot of myths around carbohydrates for sure. I think people are more confused than ever before because of so much information that's accessible and misinformation. People will scroll through their social media and see one quote expert promoting, you know, very low carb, keto, paleo, what have you. And the next quote expert is, you know, very higher carb, plant-based, and it can be very confusing.
Right.
So there's food rules on top of confusion, mixing different principles in nutrition, and then they're just stuck.
Right.
Confused. So we gotta, I call it zoom out a little bit. Look at the big picture.
For sure. So let's stick on that topic about carbs real quick.
Okay.
When back in the day, when I was not educated on the matter, carbs to me were rice, potatoes, bread, pasta. You know what? I would say that a large part of the population are still of that mindset, but carbs go far and beyond those items. Are there any carb items that, or carb foods that you think that the average person wouldn't think are carbs?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge umbrella in nutrition land. So you have carbohydrates, and underneath that umbrella is sugars, for sure. And sugars is, you know, what we think of right away, cakes and sweets and, you know, Halloween candy that I've been getting into lately. But sugars is also from your apple and your banana and other nutrient-dense stuff. Under the umbrella of carbohydrates, we also have starch. So think potatoes and pastas and those types of foods. And then if we kind of break that category even more, there's what I call slow carbs, or they convert into blood sugar slowly. They're higher in fiber, like your wild rice, your sprouted grain breads, compared to the white bread and white rice, et cetera, which are more fast carbs. They convert really quickly.
Right.
So that's going to be a big difference in terms of blood sugar control and also fullness.
Okay.
And then the other kind of subcategory of carbohydrates is fiber. Technically, it's different. So fiber is not absorbed by your body, and that it's not converted to energy. So I always try to get people to eat enough fiber. And of course, a good way to do that is foods like fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, beans and lentils. And a lot of those foods overlap with the other categories, of course.
So same train of thought. Let's stick with the carbs.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it seems like this whole celiac disease, it kind of came almost like a movement. Like over the past decade, it became very, very prevalent. Can you kind of explain what celiac disease is and how you can identify some of the symptoms?
Oh, absolutely. So celiac disease is not very common. It's in Canada, it's about 1% of the population. There's also what we call non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So celiac disease is an autoimmune disease. So symptoms would be iron deficiency. It would be constipation, extreme bloating, pain, gas, diarrhea. So a lot of those same symptoms are overlapped with IBS. And so some people think they have IBS until their doctor does a celiac screen test, which is via blood work to start. So I do encourage everyone, before trialing the gluten-free diet, to make sure to get screened. It's first a blood test and then a biopsy to confirm. But the problem is, if you go gluten-free without confirming, then you can get a false negative. Basically, what happens with celiac disease is your small intestine has microvilli, and they're like, picture like a shag carpet. They really help you to absorb your nutrition.
Okay.
In celiac disease, they're not that beautiful shag carpet. It's like hardwood floor. The villi are destroyed. They're flattened.
So they can't absorb.
You don't absorb. Okay. So that's why iron deficiency is so common.
Mm.
So you go on a gluten-free diet. If you're celiac, the villi will improve, and then you absorb your nutrients again. So you could go on the gluten-free diet and heal yourself, get the test, and say that you're negative when you're actually positive. So the screening is very important. If you get screened and you're negative for celiac, but you still find that you eat pasta or bread and you're like really bloated, pain, it's possible you could have the non-celiac gluten sensitivity, which is about 5 to 10% of the population.
Okay.
So the rest of us, the 90% is okay with gluten.
You know, I'm so shocked by that statistic.
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought that way more than 1%, just based on, you know, the way that people are talking on social media.
Yeah.
Or I think a lot of people misdiagnose themselves as well. That's probably why it seems like a lot more people are celiac, because, you know, I don't feel well after I eat X, so I must be a celiac, right? That's self-diagnosis, and that's why you say it's so important to get screened, to get that positive identification.
That's right, because there's a big difference between the sensitivity, which, you know, you can just, you know, avoid the foods that bother you, mm-hmm. versus celiac, where cross contact or cross contamination is a big deal. So you can't even share that cutting board with a gluten bread, for instance, on your gluten free bread. So it's a big deal. Crazy. So you need to know. It's not something that I would recommend to just self diagnose, for sure.
Oh man. So I didn't expect to go down this path, but this is very informative. So I want to kind of stay here.
Sure.
So you've talked about carbs being very demonized historically.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But its counterpart, fats, they're maybe not necessarily a counterpart, but fats have been demonized as well. Do you want to kind of speak about fats a little bit?
I would love to. It's one of my favorite topics.
Okay, there you go. I knew that.
Yeah. So in the 1990s, even a little bit before that, it was all about low fat. Right. Low fat everything. I remember we had low fat yogurt, we had low fat salad dressings. And what happened was we all basically ate more carbohydrates. So there's only three macronutrients. There's carbohydrates, protein, and fat. So we can't have low everything. Yeah. So now we know that fat is healthy, and there's kind of good, neutral, and bad fats. So of course, when we want to emphasize the good fats, like from plants and fish, then we know we're doing something good for our body. The omega-3 fats from fish and walnuts and ground flaxseed and chia seeds are very anti-inflammatory for the body. And we know that people have less heart disease, less cancer, less diabetes, etc., when they're eating more of these healthy fats. We know that we don't want to overconsume saturated fat. So that's fat that is more from animals that are not fish. So that's your meats, your dairy products, your butter, etc. So it's not that it's evil. It's just that we want to emphasize the good fats from fish and plants more.
So the bad fats, mm-hmm. let's not, we don't need to categorize them.
Yeah.
If you are walking down the, you know, just a standard shopping aisle, could you quickly identify a good versus a bad?
Yes. So the worst fat is called trans fat. And trans fat is a man-made fat and is from hydrogenated and partially hydrogenated oils. So the best way to see this is reading the label. So look and see, you want 0 grams of trans fat. But more importantly, reading the ingredient list and avoiding anything hydrogenated oil, partially hydrogenated vegetable oil. That's something that you want to avoid for sure.
Okay.
So it's in a lot of processed food. It has a nice mouthfeel. It has a very long shelf life. So the processed, you know, baked goods that last for, you know, a year on the shelf likely has trans fat.
So not nearly as complicated as we make it out to be.
That's right. Yeah, simplify.
Great. So nutrition labels,
mm-hmm.
they are another source of overwhelm for a lot of people, right? So as a professional in the field, you look at a nutrition label, and I'm sure you look at it, boom, you know if it's good or bad. You said looking at the ingredient list.
Yeah.
What do you do when you're reading that ingredient list and half of those terms are foreign to you?
That's very common, right?
It's very common.
And there's a lot of fear mongering about, you know, ingredients that you don't understand and pronounce, et cetera. So, you know, just because something has a long list of ingredients doesn't necessarily mean that makes it bad. However, usually we want to emphasize simpler ingredients, things that you can recognize that's closer to whole foods. So I would emphasize more of the simple ingredients that you recognize. Paying attention to the order of the ingredients is important because they're listed by weight.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you're looking at a granola bar and the first ingredient is glucose fructose.
Yeah.
And of course, anything with oats is sugar. So there's more sugar in that than oats.
Right.
Yeah.
Simple rule. Very, very simple rule. So to deviate from labels, I know that there is a little bit of a trend where more and more of us are starting to count calories.
Okay.
Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, again, I'm kind of in the messy middle in that I feel like calorie awareness can be a useful tool. I think when it starts becoming obsessive and the individual is, you know, really avoiding situations where they can't calorie count, then it can be a problem, right? When it's very restrictive and you're looking too much into the numbers. But if you're using it as a knowledge tool to look and, you know, you look up a restaurant meal, for instance, and, you know, that salad has 1200 calories and the fish tacos with the side salad has 650. You can use that calorie information to make an informed choice. But if you're, you know, restricting yourself because you only, quote, have 300 calories left for the day,
yeah,
then that's maybe a problem.
Right.
So I think it can be used in certain situations. I also think that it depends on the personality of the individual.
Right.
Yeah.
So be informed. Don't make it gospel, so to speak.
Be informed, not obsessive.
Not obsessive.
Yeah.
We are a very, very obsessive being, though. Like, that's just who we are.
All or nothing.
Like, all or nothing.
Yeah. Right?
It is our biggest downfall, whether it's nutrition, just exercise, or just anything in general.
Yeah.
So you've said a couple times so far, doing what you feel. Okay. So would you call that kind of being intuitive, leading to intuitive eating?
Yeah.
Now, intuitive eating, to me, it makes so much sense. Right, just doing what you feel is right. However, there are cases, and I'm sure there are many of them, where somebody's intuitive means eating 6 donuts at night.
Okay.
Let's talk a little bit about intuitive eating. Where do you stand on that?
I think it's fantastic.
Okay.
Intuitive eating is a large topic, for sure. There are, I have colleagues that are intuitive eating specialists or certified intuitive eating counselors. So it's a big topic. It's a lot to unpack. The main source of information, the most popular book is called Intuitive Eating. It's by Evelyn Tribole and Elise Reich. And intuitive eating, I think most of us think that it's just eat when you're hungry and stop when you're full. But that's only 2 out of 10 principles in intuitive eating. So the main kind of underlying principle with intuitive eating is letting go of the dieting mindset.
Okay.
Letting go of food rules, respecting your body at any size, no matter where you are in your journey. Also, really listening to your body's cues and not just tongue hunger, stomach hunger and mental hunger and heart hunger. Those are all a little bit different. And giving yourself full 100% permission to eat all foods.
Right.
And this feels very uncomfortable for people coming from a history of dieting.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, you say I can eat anything and everything. Aren't I just going to eat 6 donuts every night? Well, what happens is you might at first, you know, because you were restricting and you weren't allowing yourself those foods, they were put up on a pedestal.
Right.
So as soon as you restrict something, it's human nature to crave it more, right? What do you think of when I tell you don't think of pink elephant? You think of it right away.
Right.
So it feels very uncomfortable at first to think, wait, I don't have to restrict anymore.
Yeah.
I'm just going to eat all the sugar all the time. And you might. And you might eat past fullness. And you'll notice, though, you'll learn how that feels.
Absolutely.
And after a while, you've taken off that food from the pedestal now. So you'll be able to say no to that stale donut because it's not going to do anything for you.
Right.
You can then, once you heal your relationship with food, keep ice cream in the freezer now and have a half a cup and put the rest back. It's a process, but it's possible.
So I really like what you said there, because even for me, I didn't actually think of it this way, but based on what you just said, intuitive isn't just a knowing, it's also a feeling.
Yes.
So that's a very, very fascinating concept. Now, my biggest concern with intuitive is a lot of the time, especially nowadays with going back to social media, intuition is no longer your intuition. You're going to go based off of somebody else's intuition, right? It's just osmosis. I think that's just how we're structured. So somebody who is so prone to doing what other people do, how would you get them to start get the ball rolling and going based on what they believe and what they feel?
Well, I think it's important. I mean, one of the principles is to challenge the food police. And the food police, not only from others, but within as well.
Okay.
Looking at what kind of food rules do you have and why? Like, let's challenge them. Where did that come from? What are your actual goals? Do you want to be living, you know, off the diet, on the diet for the rest of your life? Or do you want to make peace with food?
Right.
So sometimes it's a lot to unpack. And often I'm referring clients out to, you know, registered psychologists, et cetera, because that's the dream team. I know where I can't, you know, dive as deep as a psychologist professional could.
Right.
But yeah, it can be many years to work on this for sure.
Right. And that food police could be in the form of your parents who you live with for 20, 30 years.
That's right.
And you follow all of their practices and their beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be very, very tough.
It's complicated.
It is. So let's leave the audience with something very, very tangible, something that they can put into action right away. So short of saying the very obvious, like drink more water, eat more greens, eat whole foods, is there anything that comes right to mind if they were to put into practice, they would start seeing progress?
Excellent question. I think right away I'm going to what makes a balanced meal. So a balanced meal would have all three macronutrients, protein, fat, and carbohydrates.
Okay.
Remembering that carbohydrates are also fruits and vegetables. So for instance, if they're used to having, you know, Rice Krispies and skim milk, that's not a whole lot of protein. There's no fiber there. Do we bump that to, you know, oatmeal for more fiber? Do we add protein by adding, you know, yogurt on the side or hemp hearts or something like that? Or fats with ground flaxseed or peanut butter, et cetera.
Right.
If it's a salad, you know, some people are just having plain old salad for lunch and then they wonder why they're starving at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Adding in some sort of protein doesn't have to always come from meat. It can be chickpeas or cottage cheese or, again, hemp hearts or something like that.
Right.
And then using real salad dressing, use real olive oil, put some pumpkin seeds on there. Make sure your meals have, for sure, protein, fat, and carbohydrates.
Great. So just to go a step further, and I don't want you to go too deep into this, but proportionally speaking, on an average meal, say, let's use dinner as an example.
Okay.
Between proteins, fats, and carbs, how do you kind of balance that plate?
Yeah, great question. So we start with protein, and that will look different depending on the individual because we know some people are vegetarian. So in general, it's about the palm size of your hand for a good protein serving, or call it a quarter of your plate. That works for a lot of people. Your carbohydrates would be about a quarter of the plate as well, or about a closed fist.
Okay.
That's about a cup. Of course, these are general guidelines.
Yeah, we're not talking about Shaq's hands who are, his hands are massive.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So a quarter of your plate protein, a quarter of your plate carbohydrates or starches, and then half of your plate produce, the vegetables, the salad, and then some sort of fat on there, be it a salad dressing, you know, oil that you've cooked with, avocado, the sky's the limit there. But that is kind of a can't go wrong. You know, if you're confused, start there. We call that the healthy plate.
Your produce, cooked or uncooked?
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Whatever you prefer, and variety is king.
Great. Well, I feel like this can go on forever.
For sure.
I can ask you hundreds of other questions, but we'll leave it there. We would love to have you back on the show. There are so many other topics, like I said, we can cover.
For sure.
So, Chelsea, what is next for you? Right now, you're doing so many different things. I know you're a big proponent of cardiovascular health. I didn't want to ask you about it. Actually, do you want to take a moment to talk about that at all?
Yeah, for sure I can.
And why you're so passionate about it?
Absolutely. Yeah, so most of my career, well, all of my career, it's been one-on-one counseling. And I've always had an interest in heart health, cardiovascular disease. And then my dad suddenly passed away from a heart attack in 2013. And so that, of course, after the dust settles and the shock, it just, you know, fires up that passion even more to help my clients reduce their risk. Because, of course, there's things that we can't control, like genetics. But let's work on the stuff that we do have control, like what we eat and how much.
Great. That takes us to what is next for Chelsea? It seems like you're already doing so much, but what is the next step for you?
Thanks. Yeah. No, I'm just working on my private practice business. It's called Chelsea Love Nutrition. Okay. It's one-to-one counseling. Most of it's virtual. So most people check in either Saturday morning coffee or even at work during their lunch break, for instance. And so, yeah, I'm just building up my practice there. And I'm also in person here in Calgary at South Centre Health and Wellness on okay. Monday evenings. So people do have the option to come see me face to face. There is something to be said about looking someone in the eye.
Yeah.
But the virtual thing has been great because people are really appreciating the convenience. And, you know, there's no traffic, especially no winter traffic, no parking and no waiting rooms. So it's been great.
Great. So I really do want to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit more about that. So what does a virtual practice look like? So when I land on your website and I choose to sign up, what does that experience look like for me as the customer, the consumer?
Yeah. So you can find me on my website at chelsealovenutrition.com. You can reach out and inquire about the program. And then I'm personally emailing you back and telling you about the options. There's two different counseling packages. One is what I call a shorter commitment. So it's about 3 to 4 months long. And then the longer commitment is about 6 to 8 months long. So then I'm emailing you the options. We schedule a 15-minute, what I call a discovery call. So I answer your questions, kind of get to know you a little bit, make sure that we're a good fit. Because sometimes I'm referring people out to experts that I think might fit the individual more.
Yeah.
Then we start with a 50 to 1 hour nutrition assessment, go over a detailed questionnaire, and then we kind of go from there.
Yeah.
So there's no one size fits all. Some people do really well with starting off with a meal plan as a tool in the toolbox, and other people don't need that at all. So it really depends on where you're at and what you need.
Great, great. Well, I'm super excited for you. You are very, very passionate about what you do. You are a wealth of knowledge. So with that wealth of knowledge, if an individual is living an evolved life, what does that look like?
Oh, gosh. An evolved life to me would be balance in life, to not feel like you're in one of the extremes, you know, either chaotic living or super strict white knuckling through misery living. We want to be somewhere in the balance. Can you, you know, live healthfully and move your body in a way that feels good and, you know, makes you feel amazing after, not because you should, quote, earn your calories or anything like that. You know, are you eating as healthy as you can about 80 to 90% of the time and allow flexibility to, yeah, order pizza with your spouse on a Friday night, or yeah, absolutely have that cold beer on a hot patio. I think life needs to include those things to be sustainable.
Absolutely. Just that balance.
The balance.
Chelsea, thank you so much for being on the show. I personally learned a whole bunch from you.
Awesome.
Take some time to digest that. No pun intended.
I love a good food pun.
So Chelsea, thanks again for being on the show, and we'll see you guys next time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of My Evolved Life. Guys, if you found any value at all, and I'm sure you did, make sure to subscribe to the podcast. If you have any questions about this or any other episode, or you want to be a guest or recommend a guest, send us a message on Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn at EvolutionVN. Oh, if you think your friends would enjoy this podcast, please make sure to share it with them. Until next time, live your evolved life.